Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In 2003, we began a three-year bicentennial celebration of the voyage of Lewis and Clark. And Talking History has been marking that celebration with periodic shows devoted to aspects of that epic event. This week, Fred Nielsen discusses William Clark with Clark biographer Landon Jones. After that, Fiona Beattie updates us on the progress of the reenactment of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And we'll conclude the show with another visit by Talking History regular Alan Winkler, who will offer us some historical perspective on the meteoric rise of U.S. Senator Barack Obama. But first, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed, this week relating to the rift that has developed between Japan and China over the writing of history. Japan's national new history textbook is fueling the deepest ebb in Japan-China relations in decades. Although read by only 18 junior high schools out of over 11,000, since it was first approved by a government screening panel 4 years ago, the text has been singled out by China and other nearby nations as evidence of Japan's trying to whitewash its militarist past. In its unrepentant tone and omission of Japan's wartime atrocities, including germ warfare and the forcing of thousands of women into prostitution, have outraged many Japanese educators. The textbook covers all of Japan's history from ancient times to modern, and the current edition devotes only 20 of its 236 pages to the period from 1920 to 1945, which was the height of Japanese expansion. The text was written by the Society for History Textbook Reform, a group of neo-nationalist academics that claims the current curriculum in Japanese schools leaves youngsters confused and no longer proud of their nation. But the approval of the newest edition in April fueled street protests in several Chinese cities, threats of a boycott of Japanese products, and violence against at least two Japanese students. Even North Korea has joined the fray, saying that the Education Ministry's approval of the text and Japan's recent push to get a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council demonstrate how this nation's leaders are political dwarfs. The textbook publishers claim surprise at the outcry. "We only hope most schools choose our book," said spokesman Yoko Ishimaru. "Japan's government has acknowledged its wartime offenses, but it has refused to compensate victims directly or apologize." Protests reached their peak on April 9 and 10 when an estimated 20,000 Chinese protesters surrounded the Japanese embassy in Beijing, pelting it with rocks and bottles and shouting, "Japanese pigs, come out," and "Be ashamed of distorting history." Similar protests took place in other Chinese and South Korean cities. And that was followed on April 18th by a seminar of Korean and Chinese historians at Nanjing Teachers University, in cooperation with the Nanjing Massacre Museum of China, to analyze controversial issues in the new Japanese history textbook and to point out its omissions and distortions. Finally, at least for now, on April 22nd, in an attempt to extinguish this nationalist furor with its neighbors, Japan's Prime Minister Yunichiro Koizumi publicly reiterated his country's feelings of deep remorse for the suffering it inflicted during its imperialist era. The Prime Minister told an audience of foreign leaders that Japan remains committed to acting peacefully, with a heartfelt apology always engraved in its mind. In a moment, Fred Nielsen examines the life of William Clark with Landon Jones. This is Talking History.
Lewis and Clark are joined forever in historical memory. The marriage of their names, we hardly hear the one without the other, can lead us to forget that they were distinct individuals. Each had a life beyond their momentous three-year expedition. A troubled man, Lewis died in 1809, most likely by suicide. Clark lived another 30 years. As territorial governor and superintendent of Indian affairs, he continued to shape the West long after his exploring days were over. My guest, Landon Jones, is the author of William Clark and the Shaping of the American West, the first full-length biography of its subject. Landon Jones has served as managing editor of both People and Money magazines. He is also the editor of The Essential Lewis and Clark, an edition of the Explorer's Journals. Mr. Jones, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Long before William Clark went west, his brother George Rogers Clark led the way for the family. He was a hero of the American Revolution, sometimes called the Hannibal of the West. And you call him the most galvanizing American leader west of the Appalachians. Tell us about him, please.
Well, George Rogers is one of the great neglected figures in American history. This is William's older brother by 18 years. Some people think George Rogers must have been William's father, but it's really his older brother. And he was the first Clark to cross the Appalachian Mountains. And it was George Rogers who led a bold expedition in what was called the Illinois Country that really thwarted the British in the American West during the Revolution. And had it not been for him, it's hard to believe that the history of our first West in Kentucky and on the Ohio River would have turned out quite the same way. So he was awfully influential in the life of young William, who looked up and hero worshipped this older brother of George Rogers.
When you get to talking about the expedition of Lewis and Clark, that is Lewis and William Clark, a famous event, you say that for all its mythic stature, that expedition was not a self-contained episode, that it was intimately connected to William Clark's earlier experiences on what you call the culturally porous borderlands and the larger agendas of international empire building. What were some of those earlier experiences in William Clark's life that prepared him for the expedition of 1803 to 1806?
Like his older brothers, William was a military man, and he had five older brothers, all of whom fought in the American Revolution. William was too young for that. He grew up during the Revolution. But he joined the militias and started getting involved in clearing the frontier of the tribes of the East as a very young man. And so in the 1890s, he was fighting skirmishes in the Ohio Country. He fought with General Mad Anthony Wayne in the famous campaign that led to the Battle of Fallen Timbers. That was the first great defeat suffered by the Confederacy of Ohio Indians. And then William saw combat against Indians. Then he saw treaty making against Indians in the Treaty of Greenville. And all of those lessons, the way treaties were conducted, the way Indian relations were conducted, were lessons that he took with him to the West when he went there.
Well, in fact, you make the point that by 1803, 1804, William Clark was the most knowledgeable American when it came to knowing things about the Western Indians.
No one had seen as much as William Clark had. He had absorbed the lessons of his older brother, George Rogers. And George Rogers, by the way, really invented the power doctrine of overwhelming force to defeat an enemy. And that was a lesson that William Clark took with him, too, that in dealing with the Indians, he relied heavily on displays of force and power. But then he also knew the Indians as individuals, and he knew them as separate tribes, not just an undifferentiated enemy. I mean, most of the settlers in the frontier saw all Indians as the same, and they were all their enemies. But William had a more subtle understanding, and he knew what the tribes were like. He knew how to talk to them. He knew how to make the Indian people respect him, which they did indeed do. And all of those lessons he carried with him into the West. With the expedition, he was the only person who really had extensive experience with many tribes of Indians, and that just paid off so much again and again during the expedition.
One of the things one notices immediately about Clark, especially if one reads the journals, is that his spelling is, what word should we use, irregular, creative?
Very, very creative.
What was his educational background?
Well, he was self-educated. His older brothers had been educated by a local school teacher, but William was pretty much self-educated, relying on hand-me-down textbooks. He clearly did not have a dictionary, and so his spelling is delightfully eccentric and imaginative. Words like mosquitoes and watermelons, you have to read it twice to know for sure what he's talking about, mosquitoes and watermelons. But having said that, he regarded himself as his own best teacher. And that was one of his mottos that he wrote in his journals. And he learned constantly. He took notes everywhere he went. He kept journals everywhere he went. He was dealing with his deeply intelligent older brothers. He never stopped learning. And I think that he was a sophisticated individual, much more so than his spelling might indicate.
Well, that's an interesting thing about the journals. Lewis is I suppose, more formally, more conventionally well-educated than his partner, and yet it's William Clark who is the real journalist of the pair. He writes almost every day.
Yeah, William did the job. I mean, that's almost a theme of his life, that he got it done. And so Lewis is in and out of the journals. About half the time he doesn't write an entry for the day. William is there almost every day, and when he misses a day, he goes back and fills in the days later. and it's very direct, it's very vernacular. When you read William's words now, it sounds like Mark Twain. I mean, you're dealing with the real American vocabulary of the early 19th century.
Clark went on the expedition with someone he had a long-standing relationship with. In fact, you point out that the longest-standing relationship was that between William Clark and his slave York. That relationship didn't age well over time, and Clark never freed him, did he?
No. When they returned to the what they would call civilization, York asked for his freedom. He had been with William, but he had been treated as an equal on the expedition, and he wanted to join his wife, who was in Louisville. And William said no, and William could not accept the idea that a slave would be given away. And the Clark family were all slaveholders, and they, to my best effort, I cannot find any example of any Clark having freed a slave in anything other than a legal charade. So as much as I love William, this is the one part of him that's the most troubling, is that he never really could get out of the circumstances of slavery, step beyond that, even though some other people did. Certainly people like Franklin and Washington had freed their slaves, and Washington did it as well. But William never could do that.
On the other side of the coin, we see Clark befriending, well, more than that, the son of Sacagawea. He, in effect, adopts the boy.
Yeah, he's a compassionate person, and that's one of the things you have to understand about Clark, that he impressed everyone with his compassion, certainly me. When you read the journals, you see him defending Sacagawea when her husband hits her. He defends other Indian women when they're being abused. He falls in love with her son, Jean-Baptiste, known as Pompey, and offers to educate Pompey in St. Louis, and in fact does. He takes Pompey in as a scholarship student and pays for his education, and Pompey goes on to a long and fascinating life, all of which was really thanks to William.
Thanks to the effort of Clark's friend Nicholas Biddle, the journals, or a form of the Lewis and Clark journals, appear in 1813. Somewhat to our surprise, we're so filled with celebration of Lewis and Clark these days, that first publication sold very, very poorly. What accounts for its poor reception?
The reason it sold so poorly was that it came out so much after the expedition. And by the time the published journals came out, people had begun to forget about Lewis and Clark. I mean, other explorers like Pike, you know, had gone west, and there were other adventurers were on their way. And the settlement of the West had proceeded at this point without any written evidence produced by Lewis and Clark. And it really was not only until after Biddle's edition comes out in 1813 and 1814, but until the turn of the century, almost, you know, 80 years later, when we finally see Lewis and Clark's original words and their original scientific evidence gathered and published.
Soon after Lewis's death, that's in 1809, Clark becomes territorial governor of Missouri. And as you describe that job, it seems almost like an impossible task. His job includes the protection of the Indians, the placating of land-hungry whites who want the land the Indians are on, and also answering to Clark's federal superiors back in Washington, D.C. Was he able to pull that off at all? Could it have been pulled off?
That's a great way to put it. I don't think anyone could have done this job. I mean, he had so many different constituencies and so many conflicting loyalties, and he was pulled in every way. I mean, he wanted to protect the Indians, but he wanted to enable the whites who settled on Indian land. He wanted to treat the Indians with humanity, as he would put it. But the government policies were quite unforgiving, and he was also told you have to acquire Indian land and kick the Indians off the land and move the Indians from the east across the Mississippi into the west. He didn't have enough budget to feed them, clothe them, house them. And he was tormented by this, and you almost see his stomach churning in the letters that I read from Clark talking when he talked to his superiors about the way the Indians were being treated. And he never could really solve that problem, and he went to his grave with it.
Near the end of your book, after describing Clark's efforts to make treaties with the Indians, he's often involved in the federal government's plans to remove Indians from the east, moving them to the west. You have a paragraph, and let me just read a portion of it. You write that in the span of his public life, Clark had been a primary architect of a form of what is called now ethnic cleansing. He personally signed 37 separate treaties with Indian nations, more than anyone in American history. He helped the United States extinguish Indian titles to 419 million acres of land. A total of 81,282 Indians was moved from the eastern United States to the lands west of the Mississippi. When one uses phrases like ethnic cleansing, as you do there, it can't sound like anything but an indictment.
I'm afraid it is. That's not the way that Clark would like to be judged, or it's not a phrase that he would have chosen. But I think ultimately it's what happened. Clark thought what he was doing was a necessary evil. That is, that the Indians were doomed. They were doomed for many reasons. They could not adapt to the white man's ways, that the liquor-toting traders would take advantage of them. And so Clark thought that the only way to protect the Indians would be to remove them from the insidious influences of the whites and remove them to the wide open spaces across the Mississippi where they could practice their wandering ways, as he would say. And that way, maybe they would buy time to make the adjustment to be absorbed and assimilated by Anglo-American culture. But there were terrible consequences of this, and he saw them happening. He saw thousands of Indians dying as part of the process, and he wrote to Washington to protest it, but he never could solve it. So he was upset by what was happening, but he was also supporting the policy that made it happen.
It seems like almost an impossible contradiction he's caught in.
Yeah, my conclusion in the book really is that he embodied all the wonderful strengths and flaws of the American character in the early part of the 19th century. And he is the key transition figure in the early republic. I mean, when you think about it, Clark had living memory of the Revolution. I can't really prove he knew Washington, but I knew Washington knew who he was. As a young soldier, Washington praised Clark. So he knows the Revolution. He knows Washington. He knows every president from Washington to Van Buren. There's nobody with this kind of breadth of experience. And then further, at the end of his life, you see the over the horizon, the Civil War coming. He is supervising the Black Hawk War, and Abraham Lincoln is fighting in that war. Jefferson Davis, the head of the Confederacy, is reporting directly to Clark. Jefferson Davis brings down the captured Black Hawk in chains to meet Clark in St. Louis. And then Clark rents out a room in his house to Robert E. Lee, a young lieutenant from West Point. So in the span of this one life, it extends from Washington and the Revolution to the people who fought the Civil War.
Clark lived long enough to see major changes in the land that he was among the first whites to explore. You note that woodlands along the Mississippi and Missouri rivers are rapidly being depleted in the 1820s and 1830s, partly to feed steamboat engines. Trapping for furs had reached unsustainable levels. Is there anything to suggest that Clark was troubled by these things, or did he see them as signs of progress?
He saw them as signs of progress. Clark could appreciate the natural beauty he saw around him, and he and Lewis both wrote about it, not often, but they wrote about it during the expedition. But they were not environmentalists. I mean, when Clark saw a beautiful hill with trees on it, he would look at it and say, that would be a great place for a fort. And he was very interested in fortifying the wilderness and in looking at places that could be cultivated and civilized, as he would say, and where cities could be built. And he didn't see the worst of it. I mean, he didn't really see the ultimate depletion of the woodlands around the rivers by the steamboats or the wholesale slaughter of the bison and to some extent the beavers that happened during but also after he died.
Well, Mr. Jones, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you, Fred.
I've been speaking with Landon Jones, the editor of The Essential Lewis and Clark and the author of William Clark and the Shaping of the American West.
Welcome back. Following up on Fred Nielsen's conversation with Landon Jones and our continued coverage of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, Fiona Beattie is here to report on the reenactment that has become one of the most popular events of the three-year celebration.
On a fine spring day in 2005, a small crowd lined at the riverbank and bluffs at Core Point, Kansas City, at the confluence of the Core and Missouri Rivers. Eyes fixed northward, they eagerly awaited sight of Lewis and Clark's returning keelboat and its crew of reenactors. The Discovery Expedition of St. Charles, Missouri, the official reenactors of Lewis and Clark's Corps of Discovery Expedition, is a key component of the National Bicentennial of the Commemoration of the Expedition. The recreation of the journey and the replica of the keelboat was the dream of Glenn Bishop, who spent 10 years building a keelboat in his backyard. Although he passed away before seeing his dream realized, his idea has taken root, and the Flotilla of Living History is recreating the journey to the Pacific Ocean and back, with stops in towns large and small where Lewis and Clark logged landfall. 200 years ago, the keel boat with its cargo of scientific collections bound for Thomas Jefferson stopped at Core Point. And, true to history, the 55-foot replica is built from Western cedar, giving it a striking reddish hue, contrasting starkly with the grey-brown tones of the mighty Muddy Mo. The crew is made up from more than 250 volunteers. Some have taken the westward route with red and white pirogues, and others are on the returning voyage. On that May day, as the keelboat came into view, the crowd cheered and clapped. A fiddler standing on the shore struck up a tune, and surge from two personal watercraft accompanying the keelboat lapped at the shore. But today, motor engines, laptops and cell phones have replaced sail and handwritten notes. Lloyd Garreau, one of the crew's reenactors, filled me in.
Now, we do dress in period attire. We do have campfires. We basically have the same type of equipment that they used 200 years ago. The keelboat is a close to exact replica of the original as we could make it. We are powered by a motor now, which really makes it easier for us. The men 200 years ago would have either been under sail or under oars all the time in order to be able to control the keelboat as it moved downriver. So we have it a lot easier. They traveled about 35 to 36 river miles a day on average, and we're doing about 25 to 30 each day. We started in Sioux City, Iowa. We'll wind up in St. Louis. They started about 800 miles further upriver than we started. So they had a lot tougher. They probably went from dawn to dusk every night. When there was a full moon, they probably moved with the full moon just to get extra mileage in, because their objective was to get back.
Learning about Lewis and Clark, the journey and the trials and tribulations of living history, is a two-way street for reenactors and onlookers alike.
Every time that we come into a community, there seems to be somebody that knows more about Lewis and Clark than we do. We share our information, they share their information. So it's a great opportunity for everybody to get involved and share information.
And interestingly, descendants of the original crew are involved with the project.
Then we have three Clarks traveling with us at different times. There's Churchill, Bud, and Charlie Clark that are traveling west.
To contemporary eyes, the keelboat looks small and a bit awkward to handle on a big river, but the crew is well prepared.
If somebody falls overboard, we know exactly what to do. If we lose an engine, we know exactly what to do as far as dropping anchors and working with a boat that's unstable. Fortunately, this spring, we haven't had trouble with personal watercraft cutting in front of us and everything. Almost every boater that we've traveled with so far has had really good boatmanship, good courtesy, stay out of our way. So we've had a very good ride so far coming downriver.
The keelboat crew are homeward bound, but not so the crew reenacting Lewis and Clark's continuing westward journey.
Right now they're in Montana, moving west. They'll take the pirogues to the Great Falls, portage around the Great Falls, and then travel by pirogue and canoe downriver. We'll use horses through the Lolo Pass and walking. Then once we get to the Pacific Ocean, we repeat the process coming back.
Now this crew not only reenacts and educates, but they can sing a fine tune as well.
We're proceeding on our great epic journey. Come join our dauntless band. For ain't no test too great for the core of discovery on our great epic journey through our great land of liberty. Ain't no test too great for the core of discovery. Come join our hearty band. Hey!
To find out more about this epic recreation, go to www.lewisandclark.net.
Teddy's dismissed.
And finally, as promised, shifting gears a bit from our focus on Lewis and Clark, Talking History's Alan Winkler returns to tell us why the life story of another important person, this one still very much alive, U.S. Senator Barack Obama, deserves our attention as historians. Winkler is Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio.
Barack Obama is making a good impression as the new United States Senator from Illinois. The African-American, born of a black Kenyan father and a white American mother, established himself as a rising star at the Democratic National Convention with a speech that was at once lucid and passionate and beautifully delivered. Now he's being hailed as a possible candidate for even higher office. Americans are getting to know Obama better through his compelling autobiography, Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance, which was originally published about 10 years ago. In it, he sketched out his background as the son of a Kenyan goat herder who got a scholarship in the United States and a woman from Kansas whom he met at the University of Hawaii. The book got good reviews and sold modestly well. Now that Obama is in the Senate, the reissued version has become a bestseller, and it warrants our attention. Obama tells in compelling terms what it was like to grow up as a black man in white America and then to come to terms with his African heritage. He recalls at one point being horrified by a picture in Life magazine of a black man who tried to peel off his own skin. He survived and prospered, graduating first from Columbia University and then from the Harvard Law School, where he was the first African-American editor of the Harvard Law Review. Obama then speaks of his work as a community organizer in Chicago before he ran for electoral office, and how the experience of working with blacks in an urban slum taught him to listen to people and to mobilize them around issues they considered most important in their own lives. But the best part of Dreams from My Father is Obama's account of his discovery of his African antecedents. He relates how Alma, a half-sister from Kenya, made contact with him, visited him in the United States, and eventually persuaded him of the importance of coming to Africa for the first time. On that trip, Obama met all of his brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, and learned the story of the father he barely knew. He also got a first-hand glimpse of issues of color and class in another part of the world. At one point during his visit, he relates how he and Alma were sitting in an outdoor cafe in Nairobi and were not served, while an American family entering the cafe after they arrived was taken care of quickly and courteously. Obama writes of how his sister furiously flung a 100-shilling note to the ground and told the waiter, "You should be ashamed of yourself. I don't care how many mouths you have to feed. You cannot treat your old people like dogs." That experience and the recognition of the need for racial harmony lies at the heart of Obama's ability to relate to blacks and whites alike. Africans are interested in Obama's story. When I lived in Nairobi, a close friend now in her 90s told me that she and her husband had employed Obama's grandfather as a cook and made it possible for him to send his son to Hawaii. Another friend turned out to have married Obama's father when his first marriage ended in divorce and he returned to Kenya to start all over again. Both women were fascinated by the younger Barack Obama's success and talked in warm terms about his larger family. And other Kenyans see the new senator as one of their own. But as he said in his keynote address, Obama is quintessentially American. Where else but in the United States, as he noted, could a skinny kid with a funny name dream of doing the things that can help us all and have the chance to make that dream come true?
You've been listening to Alan Winkler, Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio. Winkler's latest book, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Making of Modern America, will be published later this year by A.B. Longman. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.